Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Several years ago, we did a couple of shows on the subject of reincarnation with the producer of In Another Life, a documentary on the subject by Stephen Sakellarios. I recall it being a fascinating experience. Since it has been several years, I thought we might catch up with Stephen again after he contacted me to tell me about his new book, Matthew Franklin Whittier, in his own words. In this work, Stephen plays a dual role of both investigator as well as participant as he attempts to unravel the secrets of what he claims is a recent past life. Certainly an effort like this is bound to invite heaps of skepticism, and Stephen appears quite ready to take on all comers. I'm not sure he'd use the word proof to describe his book, but I think even the most cynical will appreciate the depth of research and annotation that accompanies his hypotheses. So welcome to Common Threads, Stephen Sakellarios.
Hi, Fred.
Stephen, it has been a few years since we've had a conversation, so let's do a little primer for people who may be new to the subject of reincarnation.
Sure.
Specifically, what is the theory of reincarnation as it is understood in most of the traditions that believe in reincarnation?
Well, I think it's different in different traditions, and I think that my feeling and my primary idea when I studied Eastern mysticism in general and reincarnation in particular was that there's got to be some phenomenon that's happening that's being described from different angles. So I start out really a little different than some people do. I don't think of it as a concept or a philosophy or an idea. I think of it as a phenomenon, and so then the question shifts a little bit as to how are people approaching this phenomenon. So, you know, different traditions approach it different ways. The Buddhists don't talk about any entity that continues. They think of it in terms of one, like the one candle lighting another candle, and the flame appears to be, you know, the same flame, but it really is a progression. And whereas the Hindus talk about an Atman, which is the soul, which is an entity that doesn't necessarily go from body to body, but it's always undergirding each incarnation. The real self is always there in every incarnation. And then the esotericists might talk about the astral body or the subtle body, which leaves the physical body at death, and the silver cord is snapped, and then that goes into the bardo realm or the astral realm for a while and reincarnates back into a baby, fetus, and stays with that body and enlivens it and quickens it and so on for the length of that lifetime and then leaves. So it depends a little bit on your perspective.
Let's differentiate a little bit between the Hindu and the Buddhist. You mentioned that to begin with. So, for instance, the Dalai Lama claims to be the, I believe, 13th reincarnation of a particular bodhisattva, correct?
That's my understanding. Yeah.
Okay. So what was it that passed on between the 12th incarnation and the current incarnation? If there's no soul, what is it? What is the connection between the first, second, third, fourth, et cetera, all the way up to the 13th?
Well, I'm not an expert on Buddhism, but my understanding of it would be that I think the analogy is like a stream. It's going by, but it's not really the same. You know, in other words, it looks like a stream sitting there, but it's really different water each time you look at it. So it's just effects. You know, there's a cause and an effect, and a cause and effect, and a cause and effect, and it's a chain reaction, I think, is the way they would look at it. So the previous bodhisattva set up conditions for the current one, and so forth and so on.
And the various theories that you've just mentioned, is your own personal belief system attuned to one more than the other?
Well, I'm a follower of Meher Baba, so I would go back to his teachings primarily, but I've also studied the Western studies and the Western therapies and kind of put together my own idea of what's going on from them. The Hindu Vedantist point of view would probably be closest.
Mm-hmm. And was it this spiritual search that got you interested in in investigating reincarnation to begin with?
Actually, I took it for granted for, I studied since I was about 19. We're talking 1973, thereabouts. And it just came in with all the other studies, with all the mystical studies, because I had studied the major scriptures of each of the world religions and a few more or less contemporary teachers like Mayur Baba and Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda, and I read Rumi, and I felt like I was, again, that I was looking at the same thing from different angles. And reincarnation just came in naturally. It made perfect sense to me, and I didn't really question it at all. It made more sense than anything else did. But it was when I really specifically started focusing on reincarnation was when I did my documentary and started in 1997. Then I started looking at what was happening in Western cultures and what research was going on, Dr. Stevenson's research, and people like Carol Bowman and the therapists like Roger Wilger and Morris Netherton and so on, and what were they finding? And I tried to put together what I knew about Eastern philosophies with what I was reading in this research.
Interesting. You just brought up Rumi, and I recently returned from Turkey, and I was at Rumi's tomb, which was...
Lucky you.
Yeah, it was a fascinating experience, and his tomb is actually in his, what you might refer to as an ashram, a place where he trained his students. And I spoke to a number of people who claim to be Sufi Muslims. But when you get into subjects like reincarnation, they get very uncomfortable, and they still maintain the orthodox Muslim view of a judgment in heaven or hell. How do you see Rumi as being someone who expounded on reincarnation, or did he?
Well, I don't have it in front of me, unfortunately, but there's a poem where he, in somewhat veiled language, talks about the progression of the soul from all the way from the beginning, from vegetables up through animals up to man, and he says, then man goes on to angels, and from angels into something that we can't even conceive. And it's pretty clear what he's talking about if you've studied from other teachers. But I think that the Islamic Sufis are nervous about it because it's, you know, it's unorthodox, and I think you'd have to get to know them pretty well before they would tell you, you know.
Sure, sure.
Some of them don't believe in it, some of them do. There's spiritualists that don't believe in reincarnation also. There's a big schism there as well.
Then when they are speaking to the dearly departed, where do they think the dearly departed are? Any idea?
Well, I think they conceive of it as being in an astral plane, just like somebody who believes in reincarnation would, but they don't believe that those people ever come back. And the people they're talking to on the other side also tell them that they don't ever come back. And I would call that a kind of reverse death denial. Those people don't believe they're ever going to die up there. Now my question is, what happens when one of them does reincarnate? How do they explain it? And I don't know the answer to that, but that's my guess. In other words, on the other side, like attracts like, and people who have certain beliefs all kind of congregate together. And so all the people that had certain traditional religious beliefs that don't believe in reincarnation, they're all together over there, and they all reinforce their beliefs, and since nobody's going anywhere, they might last for hundreds of years over there, so they believe that nobody's going to reincarnate.
So how do you guard against bias in your investigation, since you come to this as an adherent of a tradition that believes in reincarnation?
Well, always I try to be honest, first of all, with myself and also with the people that I reach out to in the public through my website, the documentary, and now the book. So I have to be honest about my sources, and so I've just told you what my sources are, my own understanding, the studies, my spiritual guru, Meher Baba, and the Western studies that I've read. And the best objectivity you can have is to be honest with yourself, I think, because everybody's got biases and everybody has assumptions, and so you have to try to be honest with yourself about what your assumptions are, and then honest with other people about what your assumptions are. So my assumption is that it's a phenomenon and not just a belief, and I start from there, and I probably alienate a whole bunch of people with that who want to talk about the concept of reincarnation, but this is what I've come to accept as my assumptive base. So the best way I know to be objective is to know what my assumptions are and to be forthright about them.
I'm not quite sure what you mean when you say you alienate people who want to talk about the concept of reincarnation.
Well, if they have assumed that it's a concept and they are not prepared to talk about it as a phenomenon, when I come right out of the box talking about it as a phenomenon, I've made a leap that they're not willing to make. This was one of the problems with the documentary. I start right out talking about it as a phenomenon that people are finding, they're encountering in different ways. The whole premise of the documentary assumes that it's actually a thing, you know. And the analogy that I use is that in the early days of flight, when people weren't sure it was possible, you could talk about the concept of human flight. But after the Wright brothers flew their plane, and after we had, you know, planes flying in the air, it becomes kind of too late to talk about the concept of air travel. We now have to talk about the phenomenon of air travel. Well, reincarnation, in my opinion, has gotten to that level that it should be talked about as a phenomenon, because the proof is overwhelming. If you're really honest about it and you look at it carefully with an open mind, it's overwhelming. We're at the stage where the Wright brothers have flown. So, but I think for people who are not prepared to go there, it can be offensive to talk about it as a phenomenon and not a concept.
Now, skeptics appear to have debunked a number of possible cases. Will you grant that there has been a great deal of either fraud or wishful thinking over the years? Have you come across people who indicate that they have, that they recall a previous incarnation or something, and through your study, through your research, you think, nah, this probably didn't happen?
Actually, as I was about ready to say both, but as I think about it, I've seen very little deliberate fraud. That I can't even think of a case of deliberate fraud. I've seen people fooling themselves, and this happens chiefly for two reasons. One is if somebody wants to believe that they were famous, and they find somebody that's a little bit similar to them for some reason, and they sort of latch onto that. And I will very likely be accused of that, and it's to some degree with my book, although my character was not famous, his brother was. And the other way that happens is when people go in for hypnotic past life regression and they just don't get hypnotized, and they're encouraged to use their imagination. And so they imagine, and they're not really hypnotized, so they're actually just going on their imagination. And they come to, and they become convinced of it, and they'll tell other people and so forth and so on. And you get a person who really, you know, wasn't ever experiencing anything from past life in the first place. Now, there are cases where somebody remembers something accurately and the history appears to discredit it. But history, I have found in my research, turns out to be much more inaccurate, much less accurate than we think it is. So if you look deeper into the history, very often you find that the memory is correct and the history is wrong. And I have a few cases that maybe next show we'll talk about that are like that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and today's guest is Stephen Sakellarius, and we are talking about a recent book of his. Actually, it's not published yet. Am I correct?
That's correct.
And it's called Matthew Franklin Whittier in His Own Words. Do you have any, or would you like to make public any opinion on the book that came out a couple of years ago called Soul Survivor?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that case. That was Carol Bowman's case originally, though it wasn't presented that way. It first came out in prime time, and I was fascinated to watch it because it's a strong case. Whoever produced that show did not pull any punches. Normally, when they present a case like that, they weaken it by not presenting the whole case. These guys did not do that. They presented the case in its full native strength. And it was fascinating to me to watch the interviewer, who was a very nice young fellow. And his face, at least by my lights watching it, it looked like his face just went ashen a couple times when he realized that, oh my gosh, this is a real thing. And especially I loved when the mother, I think, was telling him that when he was a little boy, they went to see a Corsair, which was the plane that he flew when he was in World War II in the previous lifetime. And his mother says, oh, look at the bomb on the bottom. And the little boy says, Mommy, that's not a bomb, that's a drop tank. So, yeah, I haven't read the book, but I know the case. And it's a real case and it's a strong case, and but there's a lot of them out there like that. The thing that's really interesting, especially interesting about this case, is that it got out without being watered down. That's what's interesting, and it's broken a lot of ground, and a lot of new ground, because it got out.
I was listening to a public radio program recently, and it was a group of scientists who were trying to debunk reincarnation, and they brought up that case, and they spoke to a psychologist, I believe from Harvard, if memory serves, and she was bringing up the theory that, well, they focused on the plane, about the Corsair, and apparently the family went to maybe it was the Air and Space Museum, the Smithsonian, whatever. They went to a museum and saw a lot of World War II planes, and apparently the Corsair was not on display at the time they went there, but that they figured, well, there was some other way he could have found out about the Corsair. But they focused solely on that. They didn't focus at all. They didn't mention the interviews with the relatives who claimed that this young man was able to talk about things that only a close family member would know. I don't know. Do you recall that part of the show?
I don't. I sort of let the skeptics talk and wait for the good stuff. That's an awful attitude. But if I can digress just for a minute, when you mentioned Harvard, quite a number of years ago, about the time we talked, I think, or a little later, I was trying to shop my documentary around to college professors. And I went to the websites of every college in the United States and Canada, the secular ones, and individually looked for the websites for every professor in philosophy, psychology, psychiatry, sociology, in those departments, and emailed them individual letters. And, you know, not just like a canned letter, but I, you know, personalized it. And when I got to Harvard, I remember that it impressed me. When I got to Harvard, it was the most materialistic school of anyone that I saw in the United States. You know? Which means that they were the most convinced that a human being is a brain and a body and nothing else. I mean, that's simplistic, but they were the most locked into that materialistic interpretation of what a human being is. There was nobody to write to in Harvard. And that was my impression that I mean, it's been a number of years, but that was the impression I came away with. So I'll just throw that in.
Now, one of the things that I do hear bantered about is that there is more of a claim for cases of reincarnation in societies where they already believe in that. Would that not indicate perhaps wishful thinking or a great bias? If in the same way that if in Western countries the belief that a soul may go, you know, to heaven or hell, there are perhaps more cases of people claiming that they visited heaven or visited hell.
Well, we certainly view experience through the filter of our culture, and parents certainly view their children through the lens of their culture. But I think I remember, I won't say definitely, but I'm pretty sure I remember talking to my father about his work on board ship. He was a merchant marine radio operator. And I piped up, I must have been pretty young, but I piped up, "Daddy, I was on ships too." And he says, "No, you weren't." You know, I mean, with the idea that was ridiculous, and I never said it again. So I think that kids that are not in a family that's open to the idea of reincarnation get shut down, and they're smart enough never to mention it again. And I think that accounts for this phenomenon. The children who are in families that are at least open-minded, their stories get out and the others don't.
Well, let's start talking about your book specifically. Matthew Franklin Whittier is the person whom you have come to accept as, is it your last incarnation?
No, I don't think so, but it's the only one that I have any proof for.
Okay, and tell us how you came to this understanding.
Well, briefly, I had a psychic reading many years ago at the Inner Space in Atlanta. You know, these metaphysical bookstores generally have psychics connected with them. So this lady was connected with the bookstore. And she told me that in my most recent incarnation, I think she said, I was a female writer on the West Coast, and that I had had some success writing serials, meaning, you know, in installments, like magazines. And so I just kept that in mind. She seemed very accurate to me about other things. So every once in a while I would look on the internet and look through female writers and look for names and see, does anything ring a bell? Well, nothing ever rang a bell very strongly. Something might seem a little familiar, or might be my imagination, I don't know. And then, I might be 2 or 3 years later, suddenly I hit a name that I definitely recognized. And it was Sarah Orne Jewett. But this woman was much further back. She was in the New England Romantic writers. She was on the East Coast in New England. So, and I looked at her and I said, I definitely wasn't her. She had a big wealthy house and everything, and I just it didn't look like anything like me. And I said, this isn't me, but this is familiar. I know that name. So after a while, I guess I mulled it over for a while, and I sent an email to my friend Jeff Keane, who was in my documentary, and seems to have a knack for synchronicity. Things just kind of happen around him synchronistically, so coincidence. So I wrote to him and I said, Jeff, I feel like I'm close here, but I can't find it. What, I don't understand it. So pretty soon he sent me back and he said, well, how about this guy? He looks like you. So what he had done is, and it's not easy to find, but if you go into the Sarah Orne Jewett Text Project website and look for her social circle, the people that she was close to, there's little bios and with a picture for, each one, and there's, 10, 12, 15. And down at the very bottom is Matthew Franklin Whittier, and with a picture of him. So I looked at that picture, and I looked at the eyes in that picture, and instantly I knew that was me. So then I started researching it. Not immediately. I kind of looked into it. I found that there was a dissertation done on him, and by some miracle I got the dissertation and read some other things on him and read everything I could get my hands on about John Greenleaf Whittier, including his letters. There's very little about Matthew in any of his material, but you can get little bits and pieces. And then, a couple, 3 years later, early 2009, I think it was, I coincidentally met someone online who happened to live in the same area that Matthew had grown up in, which is Amesbury, Haverhill, Newburyport area in Coastal Massachusetts. I didn't know anything about those places. I didn't have any idea where this person lived. I didn't recognize the town. But we started talking about this, and I'm trying to keep this person's identity secret. I'm trying not to even mention gender because they want to be anonymous. So I'm calling them the day. They started researching with me, and what they would do is send me information, and I would react to it. And I would say, I feel this, or I feel that, or this is familiar, or this doesn't seem right to me, I don't think this happened this way, whatever it was, I would react to it. And we kept a detailed correspondence, and all that correspondence is dated. So I know exactly when I felt what, and when it was either proved or disproved. So I have about a 2-year track record of almost daily correspondence with this person researching this case, and quite a bit came up.
Now, I remember in your documentary, you talked about a case of a Civil War, someone who died in the Civil War, correct?
Well, Jeff Keane didn't die in it, but he was severely wounded, if that's the one we're talking about. Yes, that's the same guy I wrote to, same guy I sent the Sarah Orne Jewett link to.
Right, okay. And in the documentary, you show a I believe it's a drawing picture of the Civil War soldier, and then we also see this person in the 20th century, and there's a remarkable resemblance. I mean, it really is quite uncanny.
Those are photographs. Yeah, those are actual photographs.
Was it a photograph?
Yeah.
Of the Civil War soldier.
That's right. Yeah, he became the governor of Georgia, so he was pretty well known.
Okay. Okay, so my question is, how much do you look like Matthew, do you think?
I'm going to put it at about 85%, which is, I think that's normal. I think Jeff is more like 95%. I think it's higher for him for some reason, and there are probably karmic reasons for that. I think I'm around 85%. Somebody else would have to judge it. There is a comparison photograph in the book.
Stephen, we are down to the wire for this edition of Common Threads, but we want to certainly continue this conversation next week. But before we go, if people are interested in your work, what can you tell them?
Well, they can get to the website at this point, and I have a blog where I keep pretty much up on it. That is www.ial.com. www.goldthread.com.
And the book, do you expect that to be in published form sometime, or are you selling it on the web?
No, I'm looking for, I have a, one agent has agreed to look at it, and I'm hoping to get a publisher. The documentary was self-published, and that's, I found the joys and the sorrows of self-publishing, and so I would really like to get a publisher and do it right.
Well, Stephen, thanks for your time, and again, we'll speak to you next week.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Fred.
You're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. Our guest has been Stephen Sakellarios, and we will talk to you next week right here on WGVU. Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Stephen Sakellarios. He's been a guest on this program before, talking about reincarnation, and we're doing it again. This time, we're talking about a book to be published entitled Matthew Franklin Whittier, In His Own Words. And this time, Stephen Sakellarios acts as both investigator and participant as he describes his own life as Matthew Franklin Whittier. And Stephen, welcome back to Common Threads.
Thanks.
So give us a little bit of Matthew Franklin Whittier's life, and if you can, tell us where you resonate with that life. First of all, what era are we talking?
We're talking the 1800s, and he was born in 1812, and he died in 1883.
And you became aware of his existence how long ago?
2005.
Okay. So, yeah, tell us a little bit. He had a more famous brother.
He did, John Greenleaf Whittier, who was one of the Romantic era poets, the fireside poets. And he became, he was an abolitionist, so he's known for that. He also became famous from writing popular poems, kind of very, he sentimentalized things quite a bit, and that was quite popular. So he really got his fame from sentimentalizing New England rural life.
And we talked about last week how some people who claim to be reincarnations of past figures tend to focus on the famous. I was Cleopatra, I was Joan of Arc, I was King Arthur. And you also sort of smile at many of those claims. But if you were going to try to, you know, puff yourself up as being somebody famous, you probably would have gone with his brother, but you actually don't resonate with that. You really feel that you were Matthew's incarnation.
His brother was really the ne'er-do-well, as he comes down to us in the history. And for those of us who remember Billy Carter, Jimmy Carter's brother, and Billy Beer and all that.
Oh, yeah.
That was sort of the vibe that you get from the history. This was the black sheep of the family.
And why is that? What did he do? What didn't he do?
Well, I mean, these are Quakers, but they're really in a Puritan society. This is Puritan New England, so you don't have to do very much. What I finally figured out is that Matthew was really a hippie ahead of his time, and there were hippies back then. And I mean, we don't know really what he did. He used a little bit of bad language in his writing, just for fun, you know, and he maybe drank some, you know, and. He was a spiritualist. He was interested in esoteric studies, but the main thing about Matthew is that he was fed up with hypocrisy, and he, for whatever reason, and I go into the psychology of it in my book, he seems to have declared a one-man war against hypocrisy, and this makes you very unpopular among people who are maintaining an appearance. So that was one of the overarching themes of his life.
And you mentioned last week that a psychic, I believe, indicated that you were Matthew Franklin Whittier in a past life, correct?
Yeah, two of them. I've had two psychic readings. The truth is I had two other ones. One of them I didn't mention it and it didn't come up. And the first half of that reading, I felt that that person made so many mistakes that I felt that it wasn't genuine. But then halfway through, they kicked it into gear and started actually hitting. And that's a very interesting thing because it shows us that there are psychics who have ability, but they get lazy and they start using the cold reading technique.
What is the cold reading?
Well, I can't give a technical explanation because I'm not sure I understand it that well. But basically, without having any psychic ability, it's possible to keep following up on your questions and the person's answers like a detective, and you can kind of get stuff out of people by association without really having any psychic ability. That's my understanding of the cold reading technique. Like, I'll talk to you and I'll ask you about your brother, and you'll volunteer something about his age, and I'll pick up on that, and you know, and then it goes on like that, and you start to build on it. It's like there's a story about nail soup where the guy comes into the village with nothing but a nail and a pot, and he asked for, you know, he's going to make soup for the whole village, and he asked for a carrot, and in the next place he asked for a potato, and he says, I'm making soup and I've got a carrot and a potato, do you have anything? They've got an onion. And by the time he goes around, he's built up a whole soup for the feeds the whole village, see, when he had nothing. So the cold reading technique is a little bit like that, I think. So this person, this psychic, will not be named, appears to have used that technique for the first half hour because see, I'm that kind of person's worst nightmare, because I volunteer nothing. For the first half hour, my policy is I volunteer absolutely nothing, and I let them sink or swim on their own. And this person was making mistakes all over the place. But then I think they panicked, and about halfway through, they started actually using their abilities because they started making hits after that. So I didn't use any of that one. And then there was another one, a psychic artist, who drew a picture. And when I got that picture, it only the eyes seemed right to me. And I was Googling images, portraits, like portrait girl or portrait woman, and I found that exact same image that she had drawn that's in the London Museum. She had copied something in the London Museum down to the curls and everything except the eyes. So I got my money back on that one, and that person will also not be mentioned. So there are frauds out there, no question. I got one fraud for the first half hour and two genuine ones. So I only mentioned the two genuine ones here. But they did confirm it, yeah.
And what is it about Matthew that you see in yourself?
That's a huge question. This is an awful answer, but you'd really have to read the book to get it, because it's very deep. I understand this person down to his toes. I can't explain it. But his personality is just like mine, with the exception that I have ironed out. I've learned a couple lessons that he hadn't learned. I've ironed out a couple rough spots. But basically, he's got the same personality, the same talents, and he has the same problems in his life. You know, it's right down the line. So, I mean, one of them is this thing about hypocrisy. Just to grab one example out of hundreds, is that I have this issue about hypocrisy too. And if you get on my website and look back way before I ever heard about Matthew, you will see that this is what I've been doing, basically. He also has a sense of humor, and he uses his humor basically as a weapon in trying to enlighten society. And I've been doing the same thing for years.
How about multiple marriages?
Well, if you count legal marriages, I've only been married once. If you count, you know, relationships, I had the same problems. And that goes into an area that I actually don't want to go into too deeply, because it's too personal. But I think that I see the same psychological pattern in his relationships that I have today, that have had.
Now, by the time the mid-1800s, you mentioned that he was a Quaker. Quakers were not persecuted by that time. It was more the 18th century, am I correct, where they really had to fear for their lives?
Yeah, but he wasn't a Quaker very long, because they kicked him out. He married a non-Quaker when he was a young man, and they kicked him out.
Hmm. Was he a pacifist or worked towards nonviolence? Do you know?
Not really, no.
Okay. Tell us about your hypnotic regression. Had you ever had hypnotic regression before October of 2008?
I had, and I'd also had non-hypnotic regression under Dr. Wolger when I interviewed him in his workshop, and I'd had a couple hypnotic regressions. The first two or three times that I attempted to be hypnotized, I wasn't hypnotized. I didn't go under. But I can. I'm not a good subject. A good subject goes deep under immediately and remembers things, but I'm not a good subject. I'm too resistant or something. But I can be hypnotized. And I would say, as I mentioned in the book, that I was under a pretty light trance during these regressions.
Well, what is a non-hypnotic regression then? You're fully awake? You stuff just comes up?
Yeah, it doesn't really matter how you get to the information. You don't have to be hypnotized necessarily. The non-hypnotic regression is the Netherton method, which Dr. Wolger uses along with its combination of, Gestalt and psychodrama, and it's based on association. So he brings you into the past life through association and through your memory and through immediacy. So the example I usually give is somebody says, I have a stabbing pain in my stomach. So the therapist will say, be your stomach, tell me what you're feeling. And the person will say, I have a stabbing pain in my stomach. He says, no, I want you to be your stomach and speak in the first person, and says, okay, I feel a stabbing pain. I feel, you know, it's stabbing. And he says, keep on with that. And all of a sudden, he'll flip into, I'm being stabbed. And the memories will start coming out. So that's the way that one works.
And when you went through this regression, you did already have the understanding that you were Matthew.
Correct.
And how do you think that may have influenced the outcome?
Well, I didn't go right into that lifetime necessarily. And I actually had I can't remember if it was two or three, it was one or two more regressions than the ones that I have in the book when I didn't go into that lifetime. The way it influences it is obvious. I mean, you're wanting to get certain information and you're thinking along certain lines and you're predisposed. And the way to fight that is to be strictly honest. And there's a misconception about hypnosis, as I've experienced it, at least the light state that I was in, that you're not yourself. You know, you're going to be a chicken, you know, if the guy tells you to be a chicken or whatever. And my experience of hypnosis is that you're awake. You're experiencing on two levels. You're experiencing being in the office. You're awake. You have your full faculties and your ethics and everything else. And you're also experiencing stuff that's bubbling up from somewhere. That's coming up. You're remembering things that are bubbling up of their own accord. And what happens is if the therapist tries to suggest anything contrary, you'll argue with them. Never mind being suggestive. You're not suggestive. You're combative. You know, I've seen this in many cases with like Marge Reeder's work with the Mission to Millboro series. They would argue with her. So whatever's forcefully bubbling up from underneath somewhere, you stick with that and you say, no, it's this. So it's very different from the popular conception.
Tell us a little bit about Matthew's family. And I have read that, say, in Hindu and I don't think about Buddhist literature, but certainly in Hindu literature, there is the theory, the thought that you bring other people with you from lifetime to lifetime. That is to say, your brother could end up being a very good friend, or your former brother could be your wife, or your kid, or somehow one soul is going to attract another soul. How do you respond to that theory, number one? And number two, in your experience as Matthew, do you see this phenomenon?
Well, I know that he was primarily attached to his brother, John Greenleaf Whittier. I don't have a sense of anything before, any lifetimes before, but I know that that was his primary attachment in that family. The only person that I know of where there was a previous life was Matthew and his first wife, who I think was his soulmate. I feel that she was his soulmate. And one, Abby, and there was one previous lifetime with her that did come up in the regressions. But I don't know about any of the others. I'm sure there were connections, but I don't know what the past life connections might be.
But you're saying, like, right now in your life as Stephen, you don't feel that you have an Abby in your life?
No, I'm in touch with her on the other side. She hasn't reincarnated, which is another... I haven't really gone into that in the book very much, but it's all over my website, and it's another controversial aspect of what I'm doing.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association, and today we're talking with Stephen Sakellarios. And his book that has yet to be published, but you can find out all about it on Stephen's website, is Matthew Franklin Whittier, in his own words. So, Stephen, let's talk about this timeline that we mentioned last week. You have recorded, apparently quite diligently, your indications, your feelings about your life as Matthew, and... what has been given to you by this, I believe, was a psychic, am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us how you think that this timeline provides ample evidence for your claim.
Sure. Well, it's not all in the timeline, but I'll go through it. In 1998, I created a page on my website that was just fun. I was working on my documentary. I had gone to Pennsylvania and Maryland, the Antietam Battlefield in Maryland, and then Media Pennsylvania, where I interviewed Carol Bowman. And traveling, I took pictures as I was traveling through rural Pennsylvania. And when I got back, I created just a kind of silly glimpse, you know, with all the pictures, and kind of explained them in ways that were totally ridiculous. But that was way before I ever heard of Matthew, because I heard of him in 2005. This is 1998. But if I go back and I look at Matthew's writing and the style of his humor, and I look at this thing that I created in 1998, it's eerily similar. So there's one. It would be up to, you know, somebody else to judge, to look at it and say, you know, because I'm not the best judge of myself. But to me, it's got a lot of parallels in terms of my style of humor and what I was doing with it. Around year 2000, I was interviewed by a young lady named Sherry Divers, who was a metaphysical person in Atlanta, had I think it was a website. I was interviewed for the website, and I gave my answers in print. And in that interview, I told her that I felt that, she asked me about what past lives I knew of, and I said that I felt that I had been peripherally connected to the Romantic writers. And I didn't think I was one of the major ones, but I was connected somehow. So we have that publicly. You know, it's been on my website for quite a number of years. So I have a public statement of that. Let's see, the timeline says that on 2005 was when I first mentioned online that I felt that I may have been Matthew Franklin Whittier. So that's now public knowledge as of 2005. And it was October that I first read the dissertation about him. And it goes on like that, but that gives you an idea of what the research timeline is designed to do. It's designed to show when I first said something versus when I confirmed it to whatever degree. I don't use the word proof. I don't like the word proof, because proof comes in different flavors, colors, and degrees. But it's designed to show when I said something versus when I could possibly have known it, you know, however many years or months later.
Sure. Strong evidence, you might want to call it.
Yeah, and some are stronger than others. Some of it is, there's one or two things that did rise to the level of proof, I would say.
I'm sorry, again?
I say there were one or two things that came up that, to my mind, hit the level of proof. Most of them were suggestive. Most of them were plausible. I would put 90% of what I came up with in the realm of plausibility. You know, I had a feeling, I had a reaction, and it turned out to be plausible. As a matter of fact, basically they all turned out to be plausible, and that's pretty amazing in and of itself, because I stuck my neck way out. I said things that I had no idea if they were plausible or not, you know, and they turned out to be plausible, and they all turned out to be plausible. So that's a kind of proof in itself. But there were a few things that really were proof.
How did Matthew Franklin Whittier die?
He had an illness of some kind, and it was officially diagnosed as rheumatoid arthritis, I think it was. And I had felt, here's one that I hadn't written down as an example. I had felt that it must have been lung trouble involved, and there was no mention of it anywhere that I could see, lung trouble. And the reason I felt that way is in this life, I've always felt safer sleeping, sitting up. And I thought, well, the only reason I could have that is from a past life. I must have had trouble with my lungs filling up, and I was afraid I was going to choke if I didn't sit up. So, you know. So finally, I found an obscure footnote in John Greenleaf Whittier's three volumes of letters that he mentions lung trouble as well as the rheumatoid arthritis. Now, I feel that it was his last job that he had that killed him from stress. I think that he had an ulcer, because under hypnosis, what I remembered is terrible stabbing pains. Let's talk about stabbing stomach pains. I had terrible stomach pains, and my feeling about it is that I probably had an undiagnosed ulcer.
And I've never heard of anybody dying from rheumatoid arthritis. Is that something that people used to die of, but they don't die of anymore?
I looked it up, and it's kind of ambiguous. It can get really serious, but I think normally you don't actually die of it, no.
Okay. And your condition, you still maintain a sitting position when you sleep?
If it somehow or other feels more comfortable to me, yeah. As though at one point it was safer. I just feel safe and secure when I'm sleeping, sitting up. It's a clue, you know.
Sure. We often have interfaith panels where people from various religions, hold forth, give a little bit of their faith tradition to the audience. And I know that sometimes when we've had, say, a Buddhist or a Hindu on the same panel with a Christian or a Muslim, the question from the audience often comes up to those people who do believe in reincarnation, isn't it an almost hopeless situation to just believe that once you leave this body, you're not going to be done. You have to keep on going and going. You know, why would somebody want to believe in reincarnation when the other options seem easier? And is reincarnation a punishment? How would you respond if you were on such a panel?
Well, I don't think of it in terms of a punishment, but, you know, not wanting to believe in something has never been, you know, one of the things that stops it from being real. Things are as they are. So my response to that is, let's look at what is, and never mind what we want to be.
And if it isn't a punishment, what is it?
Well, it's a learning process, but it's an experiential learning process. It's a process of gaining wisdom. And then there's an end goal to the thing, which Hinduism talks about, realization. But in the long interim before that final realization, there's a long period of developing character, of developing insight, of developing wisdom, of learning, gaining certain traits, of gaining patience, of gaining tolerance and understanding and strength, and it goes on and on and on. All the things we think of as virtues, it's a matter of fine-tuning one's personality and one's understanding and developing talents, you know.
So do you think, when you look at Matthew's life, are there some parts of it where you could say, aha, I have made ground in this area?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Matthew was cynical. He became cynical against society because of being, I think, shunned, and because of his, you know, war against hypocrisy and so on. And I have, and he could hurt people. I think he could say things that were very cutting and hurt people's feelings in his humor. You know, as a matter of fact, the man, Artemus Ward, I forgot his real name, that's the pseudonym, took after Matthew some years later, kind of adopted his style, and he's credited with being the first stand-up comic. So Matthew really is behind all the stand-up comics that we see today. And, you know, he had that same edge, and he could hurt people. So I have learned not to hurt people's feelings, not to use my humor. And if you see that lighter side humorous piece on my website that I did in 1998, you will see that I make myself more the butt of my own jokes. I don't hurt anybody else with them. See, anytime I mention anybody else in that piece, I'm not hurting them. Whereas Matthew would cut people down.
And is this something, do you think, that came fairly natural to you in this lifetime?
Not at all.
No, you had to get your rear kicked a couple of times.
I was very acerbic as a teenager, you know, and kind of came to grips with it when I began studying religion and spirituality as a, you know, in 1920, you know, finally came to grips with it. But as a younger man, and this is typical, your traits from a past life will recapitulate in childhood and adolescence and so on. So if you want to look at who somebody was last time, just look at them as teenagers, basically.
And what about when you were very young? Other than the fact last week you mentioned that you felt you were on ships before, when your father was talking about himself being on ships, have you had any confirmation through the life of Matthew or anywhere else that you were indeed on ships?
Well, Matthew spent a little time on ships and wrote about it in a humorous vein, but I can't think of anything that would confirm that. I did have a past life regression where I was, one of the past life regressions, which are in the book, I reproduced those two regressions verbatim in the book, and one of them did talk about a shipboard lifetime, but I already knew about that or felt I knew about it. So, you know, you can't say that's evidential, really.
I have read the writings of certain people, Hindu teachers, Buddhist teachers, or people of no particular tradition who accept the concept of reincarnation, or the phenomenon, as you call it, yet guard against, or I don't know if warn is a good word, but indicate that focusing too much on one's past incarnations is not necessarily healthy, or nor does it lead you to that realization that you just mentioned. Your response?
Well, I tend to agree with them, and there's a lot of variables. It depends on, you know, some people can handle something pretty well, and some people, it throws them for a loop. So there's the individual to be considered. It helps one to understand patterns. If you study a past life, you understand your own life in larger patterns, and that's always helpful. On the other hand, the past life can bleed through and start overwhelming you. Things that, for example, when I immerse myself in the research about Matthew Franklin Whittier, his emotions would start coming through, and I would find myself saying things that were cutting, that hurt other people's feelings, where I would normally never do such a thing. I also would find myself being extremely discouraged about my career, which is, you know, troublesome in this lifetime, but he was even more depressed about it and desperate, you know, about it then, and I find those desperate feelings would start coming in. And other things, you know, like that. His whole personality would start to bleed through, and things that I had pretty much thought I had a handle on would start surfacing again. So it's not to be fooled with.
Understood. Stephen, we're out of time once more, but we certainly do appreciate your time here on Common Threads. Once again, your website.
It's www.ial.goldthread.com.
Okay, wonderful. And your book, hopefully published, Matthew Franklin Whittier, in his own words. We hope to be able to see that on the bookshelf sometime.
I hope so, too. Thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome, Stephen. You're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. Please join us again next week. I'm Fred Stella.